I want to tell you about something new that makes sense. It's called Ting. It's a reseller of Sprint Network. It's different because there's no contracts, right? No bundling, nothing comes along with it. No overcharges or penalties. So if you use more than you thought you would, you just pay. You already paid. There's no further payments. There's unlimited devices on one plan. Now, you bring your own device, but you can bring as many as you want. And messages, megabytes, each device on a plan costs a flat $6 per month. There's credits for unused services. This seems too good to be true. No add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. It's all very clear, and there's continuous customer support. You just call 855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, and you'll get a person who speaks your language. There's excellent support, amazing clarity, good services, the right price. Why wouldn't you do it? That's why Ting is called the mobile service that makes sense. Now, I want you all to go to drew.ting.com to receive $25 off your first device purchase or $25 in service credit if you bring your own device. You can also go to podcast1.com, click on the Dr. Drew podcast page, and click on the Ting banner.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. I'm joined by my Loveline compatriot, Michael Catherwood.
Hey.
And Mike, keep that music up for a second. Mike is dancing to the groovy music. I want you to know,
Who handpicks this stuff?
Me and Chris.
You do?
And we now have a CD out. We have a CD out of handpicked music just like this. You can get it. Yes. Give another taste of something else. Get it at iTunes or get it at drdrew.com. Yes.
That's actually pretty cool music to have like a cocktail party.
Too. Right?
Yeah.
It's good, right? It's very mad.
You know what it sounds? I was about to say, it sounds like something Don Draper would listen to when he's not at work.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so there you go.
Megan, I've got to get creative.
Peggy would listen to it too somehow, I think. But all right, be that as it may, I haven't caught up on Mad Men yet. I'm still with the Martin Luther King assassination.
Oh, you're going to come.
Did you see last night?
You're going to actually make a mess in your pants. Last night, it all goes down. All goes down, both professionally and personally.
Oh, man.
For everyone involved.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay, I got to sit home and watch Mad Men. Okay, so Michael Catherwood, he and I do this little radio show called Loveline.
Yeah.
Mike and I are both sort of, would nerd be the right, what's the right word?
You were definitely geeky about
it. Geeks. We're geeks when it comes to nutrition and working out and stuff. I don't ever talk about it publicly, probably for a series of reasons. One, because I'm really not expert in it, so I have no business talking about it. I have my own personal experience with it. I take issue with a lot of the bullshit that's out there because I can see bullshit when I see it.
And it's plenty.
Oh, plenty.
In this industry.
Yeah. But there are real experts out there, and Mike and I wanted to bring in a real expert today. And we are going to be joined by Lyle McDonald. In fact, we've got him on the line. But before I go to him, I just want to talk about our sort of history with this.
Yeah.
You have a long history with working out.
And also, I mean, to get back to you, why you don't really talk about it on the air so much is that people can misconstrue things that people say in when it comes to diet and fitness and things like that. And I guess the stakes aren't so high when it's me spouting off. When you're a doctor, people may mishear something you say, and then next thing you know, they're eating 500 calories for 3 weeks.
Not only that, I'm really not an expert in it, so I really don't have any business.
But you know what? No, neither are a lot of people
who
make that claim.
So I can call out bullshit. Yeah. I know bullshit when I see it just by virtue of the way they describe it. And you have a friend, Lyle McDonald, who's a real expert.
Well, I mean, he's not a friend. I would hope he can become my friend sometime.
You admire.
I've actually – I am, like you said, Dr. Drew, overwhelmingly geeky when it comes to diet, nutrition, and even at the time – at certain points in my life, drugs when it comes to getting lean and gaining muscle mass.
Okay, so let's talk about – I'll tell you my history with working out and nutrition, then you say yours.
Okay.
I started working out in high school, like 14. I was kind of a big kid. I was doing it for football. I do it in the springtime and the summer. And then somewhere during college, it sort of became like an important, like an obsession. Like I was doing it every day. And then during medical school, it got even worse, where I was like, had partners, and I'd lift heavy for an hour and a half a day, and I couldn't survive if I didn't work out. And it just was sort of part of my, it felt like part of my mental health as well as sort of an exercise bulimia.
Yeah.
But I really felt like I needed to do this every day. And I was working out around a guy named Bill Pearl.
Oh, yeah.
Who, Bill Pearl wrote the, a famous book. I'm sure a lot of people know it.
He's a pro bodybuilder from the 60s, 70s, but didn't he have some sweet nickname like the Pasadena Pearl or something?
Something. He invented bodybuilding, basically. He was really one of the first pioneers and wrote this Bible on bodybuilding. And so I was around his sort of notions and how to work out and how his disciples. You know, Bill was somebody I would talk to, but yeah. I was a kid. You know, I wouldn't really, really talk to him very much. He was really, really a cool guy, though. And there were a lot of guys using steroids and stuff around then. I would sort of hear and listen and see what was going on. I never did any of that. I would have loved to have been fantastic to have been able to do that. But I tried to adjust my diet, and I never was very good at it. I was always a little too much. Like eating too much. I liked carbs too much.
Yeah.
But I would always try to push the proteins. And Pearl himself actually tried to put me on a 40-gram carbohydrate diet one time. I remember that. He was like, you should eat 40 grams of carbohydrate, and that's it.
Ketogenic diets have been around for a long time. You know, really
that
low.
That was 40 years ago. You know, and so I have a gym in my garage. I still work out on a regular basis. I lift heavy weights, and I've seen that as the main thing that both you and I sort of feel like that's an important part of certain kind of working out.
Sure. Yes.
And I don't really get much out of anything else, even though I've had trainers and been exposed to everything else. I don't get anything out of it. Not only do I not feel good, I just don't look – I don't like it. It's not rewarding to me the way lifting heavy weights is. I'm just sort of have a lot of slow twitch muscle.
It could be, I was going to say, the structure of your body and all that.
But no one ever talks about that.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of stuff I want to talk about. Your story.
Mine is kind of similar. I got into weightlifting from high school sports, and it turns out, you know, some people – can naturally run fast. Some people can jump high. I was always a good athlete, as in I was good at sports, but I was never naturally an athletic guy. I'm kind of uncoordinated and gawky, and I walk like a guy much more muscular than I really am. I have bad pot. I'm just not a coordinate. Anybody who's watched my time on Dancing with the Stars knows I'm not a graceful guy. But I always could lift heavy. I always had a thing for it.
Always strong.
And I took to it as soon as I – and most kids my age, when you're 15, 16, you start lifting weights, you want to like bench heavy and curls and have big guns. I had a guy, my brother-in-law, and then another guy who was the strength coach at San Marino High School at the time. And he didn't hang around for a long time. I was lucky enough to get in at the high school I went into, and he showed me how to deadlift. And But I'm kind of short for my size, and I got short limbs. So biomechanically, I'm just set up to do it. And I could pull heavy weight right out of the gate. I started deadlifting tons of weight. And I was addicted to the feeling of, like, really lifting heavy. And then I got introduced to anabolic steroids about 2 years later. And by the time I went into high school, probably 135, 140 pounds. And I graduated high school like 210 pounds. Yeah.
Oh, 80 pounds of muscle.
Yeah. Holy, I mean, granted, you know, that you're going through that growth spurt anyway.
Yeah.
And a lot of it wasn't. It wasn't 80 pounds of muscle. It was 55 with 30 pounds of spare tire. You know, but I'm saying, like, let's not – I'm not one of these guys. Like, I had a friend that I used to train with and inject with. And he was one of those kids that he was like tall and lean. He was kind of similar build to, like, he was a tall guy with broad shoulders, but he was naturally lean. I was not. I mean, you've met my parents. My mom's a midget and my dad's a fat ass. So I have the worst genetics on both sides. My dad's 5'7", my mom's 4'11". I'm not kidding. My dad's probably 350 pounds of blubber. And my mom has little teeny bones. So I mean, I'm just not a big guy. But I threw on the muscle as anyone would if they were lifting consistently and doing that. And then once I turned about 19 or 20, I started to really take to like narcotics and drink. And I'm a bad alcoholic. You know, we've talked about on Loveline. It's part of the deal of me even hosting that show is being open about my recovery. And so that kind of went downhill. As soon as I got clean, about 21, 22, got clean for good, then it actually became an addiction. I became so obsessive about...
But no more steroids, though.
No. I became so obsessive, though, about how I looked and training and eating and weighing my food.
You were
and
actually
that.
A competitive bodybuilder at one point.
Yeah.
Early when you were using steroids.
Yeah, and then when I was clean, too.
Did you win anything?
No. But you know what? I would have... I'm not going to get into pissing match, but... The cutoff for lightweight at this one show I did, right, was 169 pounds. And I weigh in, and on a digital scale, 169.5.
Oh.
And I go, you guys aren't going to make me compete middleweight because the guys in here this are 190 pounds or something
huge.
Like that.
Yeah.
can I go take a piss? And come on. No, no. It's, I was like, you understand I've been dehydrating, do all this to get to 168, and I'm 169. I'm 169.6 or something. No. So either way. So then I get obsessive about it, and I start to kind of research and go over the top on just filling my brain with the what I think to be the best information on how to stay lean, how to build muscle, how to lose body fat, all these things about, you know, physique training. And then I got it started going into more human performance. I got obsessive about, like, the idea of really pushing the envelope of how, with modern science and training training information and everything that's available, what you could really do with the human physique. And that's when I came across our guests' writing and stuff. And there's, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, there's so much bullshit out there in the fitness and nutrition industry. I find Lyle McDonald to really be at the top of the field as far as a guy who has gone out of his way to research it from a clinical and scientific standpoint, and also with anecdotal experience of training himself and then training other clients. His books, The Ketogenic Diet, that he's worked on a long time ago, and then now Ultimate Diet 2, have been indispensable for me in my own achievements.
And to be clear, you have no financial investment in his stuff.
Absolutely
not. Neither of us have any relationship, but I've never met him before, and this is just your studied opinion.
Yeah.
You came on this guy and you said, we should talk to this guy.
He's certainly not the only person in the industry that you should listen to, but he is definitely one that I would put my name and my money behind. I have invested in his products.
And you've studied for 10 years.
Yeah, I think he really is. Because, like I said, he's someone who doesn't have a vested interest in supporting the bullshit. He's just done research and done a lot of training and has seen how to do it. And also, what I really appreciate is that he'll be fully forthcoming in certain things, like with his diet, his writing on protein-sparing fast. He'll come out and say, look, there is substantial risk to doing this, but if you want to lose body fat really quickly, go here. There is substantial risk to using bromocriptine, but if you want to lose body fat and gain muscle, do this. You know.
So, gentlemen, if we could put the books up on the website, I've got a list. I'll read them now. They'll be available. You can click through at Amazon.com. You can get them up at drdrew.com. Applied Nutrition for Mixed Sport, The Stubborn Fat Solution, A Guide to Flexible Dieting, Bromocriptine, which you mentioned, The Rapid Fat Loss Handbook, and The Ketogenic Diet. It is my pleasure to welcome Lyle McDonald to the program. Bodyrecomposition.com is where you can find Lyle. Lyle, did you hear that intro from Mr. Catherwood?
Yeah, no, I did. Thank you, Mike. And Dr. Drew, I kind of warned Gary and Mike that I was going to be a little bit of a fanboy if I should get this out of my system. I've been listening to you since, like, my college days. I went out to UCLA. I used to listen to Love Lines on KROQ back in the early 90s.
Wow.
I've on and off watched Love Lines, read the books, love your, like, for me to be on this show with you is an honor. And it's, you know, you, I remember I heard you ask Mike kind of how this all happened, and someone, a bodybuilder named Skip LaCour, actually told me that Mike had mentioned me on the show, and that's why I contacted him proactively. And when he said he could get me on the podcast, I was like, just tell me when, and I'll be sitting by my phone. So I cannot tell you how happy I am to be here.
Well, it's funny. It's a mutual admiration society because you know, you heard Mike's gushing about you. He's been talking to me about you for a long time. And so I really appreciate you coming on and giving me this opportunity.
Fantastic.
And this is a non-Loveline, non-typical Dr. Drew podcast kind of day. We are really going to geek out on nutrition and sports.
Fantastic.
And I suppose let's sort of frame this first with how people should use this information as we get into it. The average person is not going to be a weightlifter like Mike and I. The average person is just going to be interested in diet. So let's start with sort of general diet recommendations. How about that?
Oh, no, absolutely. I would say probably, you know, when people find out kind of what I do, the biggest question they always ask me is like, well, what should I eat? Because you know how it is. Everywhere you look, there's a new magic diet, a new superfood, a new this, a new that. And people are confused, and people are scared, and eggs were bad, and now they're good.
And meat was good, and now it's bad. Lyle,
yeah.
99% of it is bullshit?
Yeah, probably more than that.
I would say it's
a lot of scare tactic mongering, and what you see in diet, which is true of many things, people want an enemy. They want to have one thing that they can focus on because it's easy. So I was talking to a girl the other day, and she's like, well, all the girls at my school say you should eat dried fruit instead of whole, or whatever it is, or it's trans fatty acids, or it's high fructose corn syrup, or it's cholesterol. People, you'll go, they'll go, I'm not losing any weight. And I'll go, well, what are you eating? Like, well, I just make sure I don't eat any of food X. And I'm like, but
gluten,
how much
yeah.
are you eating?
Yeah.
Like, they get so fixated on details that are so microscopically irrelevant in the big scheme.
So give us the big scheme.
What should people eat?
Yes.
I tend to sort of work from, and this is just, you know, you'll find this in all of my books. You know, my first book was about low carbohydrate dieting. But one thing that I don't do is I'll never, ever say this is the one and only approach that works for everybody, because it's not only untrue, it's intellectually dishonest. Mm. That's what most books say. We have the one true. Diet has become like a religion. Low carbohydrate diets work fantastically for some, okay for others, and not at all for some people. High carbohydrate diets work fantastically for some people and terribly for others. And I tend to look very much at context, training, genetics, stress, insulin sensitivity, gender, you know, these are the questions that really determine things. But even within that, there is a template. Like, there are certain requirements I like to see of any diet. And it's funny, you guys were talking about Bill Pearl and bodybuilding. And actually, the name of his book was Keys to the Inner Universe, Part 1. Part 2 never did come out.
That's right.
But it was 500 pages of exercises, and he was really, along with Arnold, even actually before Arnold, sort of post-John Grimek, post-50s, really in the 60s when bodybuilding was starting.
Yep.
And one of the things the bodybuilders said for decades was protein, protein, protein. And the dietitian said, no, 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 no. And now in 2013, we know protein. Critically important for health, tends to blunt appetite. Very important, you even sort of mentioned this, is with older age, there's a thing called sarcopenia, which is age-related muscle loss. And the two things that can really prevent that are sufficient dietary protein and heavyweight training.
Yeah.
The bodybuilders were saying that 40 years ago,
uh-huh.
and the scientists said, nope, nope, cardio, 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 carbs, 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 and now we know better.
Well,
I'm going to stop you, Lyle, right there.
But
yeah.
But those of us, you also heard us talking about how we like heavy weightlifting. You know, But here I am. I have metabolic syndrome. I'm male.
Right.
You know, I respond to high protein diets and, you know, low carb
sure.
diets. I really respond to those like crazy. It's like ridiculous.
And honestly, I'd say, you know, for most people, you know, the reality is we live in an obese world. The majority of people are overweight, probably do have pre-metabolic syndrome or pre-type 2 diabetes or however you want to look at it. Usually the people that do best with high carbohydrate diets tend to be extremely active endurance athletes. They're doing 1 to 3 hours of activity a day. They're lean. They've got certain genetic backgrounds. If I were, you know, for most people, lowering carbohydrates, not necessarily to the low point, but just lowering them is probably not a bad thing. You know, and I don't really like to use percentages, but if you remember the old zone diet? It was kind of a high protein, moderate carb, like that's probably the best generic diet I would ever give somebody. Would be like, get plenty of lean protein, you know, we're talking chicken, tuna, eggs, you know, some fatty red meat is okay in moderation, just don't go nuts with it. You know, moderate amounts of carbs, plenty of fruits and vegetables. I've joked that I was going to write a book called The Your Grandmother Was Right Diet.
Yeah,
what did grandma always tell us? Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. You can't go wrong with that.
Now, let's zero in a little bit further on some of those recommendations. Now,
sure.
Because Mike starts to micromanage that stuff, and I don't have the attention span for it.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I micromanage it because I'm a guy who weight trains incredibly intensely
and
then lives an incredibly active lifestyle.
And
I get so many emails, Lyle, when I even mention
sure.
things like health and fitness on the air, and kids who a 37-year-old female who exercises once a week wants to follow my diet
right.
and expects to get those results.
Right.
And that sort of goes to that context thing. Now, if I'm prepping a bodybuilder or a powerlifter, and they have to drop weight, you know, to not be 168, 169.5, and maintain strength and performance, I'm going to micromanage the hell out of that. If I'm dealing with a beginning exerciser at 37% body fat, I just need to get the basics out of the way.
Right.
And what I find in this field, you know, a lot of bodybuilders, a lot of fitness types, they project. They think that, well, this is what I do. I eat these exacting numbers in grams, and that's what everyone should do. And it scares people off. When people are just starting, I look for big red flags. I had a client years ago, he was drinking like 4 sodas a day. And I said, look, the only change in your diet I want you to make is either go to diet soda or water. and he started losing 2 pounds a week with that one change.
Yeah.
If I told him, you need to eat every 3 hours, 37.2 grams of protein, all these, he would have lost his mind. I always look with beginners, I look for generalities, and I look for the big, where can I have the biggest impact with the smallest change?
And yet
with
people,
psychotic bodybuilders, then you're looking at micromanaging a lot of details.
And yet people do like, they kind of gratified by looking at some detail. So let's
sure.
let's bore down a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
Like for instance,
absolutely.
Like for instance, what kind okay. of carbohydrates are best? Mike's always trying to get me to do sweet potatoes.
Correct.
Tell me about
and
that.
See, and I come from sort of, and this is, you know, that Guide to Flexible Dieting you mentioned, which is probably the book I wish more people would read and is possibly the one the fewest people have read because the title sucks, is within a certain limit, I kind of don't care. I really don't care what carbohydrates people eat. However, certain types of carbohydrates are far easier to overeat than others. It's a whole hell of a lot harder to overeat baked potato than it is greasy French fries or jelly beans, which is my own kind of private problem. But, you know, clearly
as you
get into more refined, higher glycemic index, you know, the really refined carbohydrate, sugary stuff, you can eat 1,000 calories of jelly beans and not be full. And 1,000 calories of baked potato would make you want to throw up.
Right.
So, you know, for people don't like counting. They don't like doing numbers. They don't like measuring.
Right.
And a lot of diet books really pander to that. They give you a set of rules that you can't overeat on unless you really, you know, so it's you can eat all the vegetables you want. You
right.
can eat
Which is
all
true.
Of the plain baked potato you want because no human being can overeat a baked potato. They cut out all the problem foods. You know, so for most people, within a range, you know, the less refined, the better. With the more,
well, that's
a, you know,
hang on a second. That's a very. I yeah. think that's right there is a quite a pearl because I think I kind of already do that, but I don't give myself really permission to eat. Really, it's eat as many vegetables as you could possibly cram in your body. You can't go wrong with that. And then
it's pretty hard. You can do it. Like smaller women can actually. I've known them that eat like a pound of cabbage. It is possible to go overboard with it, but it's damn hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's very rare in this industry for you to ever hear anybody say, you know, I'm just so fat from all the broccoli I've been eating. It's just,
bingo.
You know,
it just
bingo,
bingo. For a male, particularly for somebody that's exercising. And then the idea that if you're going to eat carbohydrate, baked potato, sweet potato maybe is the way to go.
Or just more filling things. I mean, I'd like to reference a study that I actually saw on bodyrecomposition.com where they took the macronutrient breakdown and caloric intake. It was almost exactly the same of some organic grass-fed beef and then a fast food meal. And chemically, the way the body reacted to it, absolutely no difference.
But you have to know which ones to select.
Right. And people don't make enough.
Certain foods are more filling than others.
Right.
From a practical standpoint. Like, now, bodybuilders will count and micromanage, and there's also some psychological benefits to be had from occasionally allowing those, you know, the quote-unquote bad foods. And I don't really like to think in those terms because it puts people in this weird mindset of negativity and all this, you know. And there's, you know, because that's the other thing. Bodybuilders and athletes, adherence is never a problem. They'll do whatever the hell you tell them. For the general public, you know, we've known how to lose weight for 30 years. We know how, we know that. What we don't know how to do is how to get people to do it for more than 3 weeks. I mean, Dr. Drew, you know, you see this in addiction.
Yep.
We know what needs to be done. Behavior change is damn near impossible for most people.
It's hard. That's right.
90% of people fail at any behavior change. Smoking, alcohol, drugs, food. You know, food is even more difficult, and I will get back to your original question, I promise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with an alcoholic, you can go, stay out of the bars. Don't be around alcohol because that's a subconscious trigger. With addicts, you go, just don't be around your drug-using friends. You cannot avoid food in this society. We are surrounded by commercials, food, tastiness, smells. Our entire, you know, social structure revolves around food. Changing food eating habits is much, much, much harder in that sense because unless you're a shut-in, and a lot of bodybuilders are, you are surrounded by it. And food triggers, commercials, tastiness. It's all the same psychological triggers as for addiction. It's just you can't get away from it.
Do you have
that makes changing those eating habits a whole hell of a lot harder.
Do you have any guidelines?
So for those people, for the average obese individual, if I tell them you can never have French fries again, that's not a diet they can stick to.
Yeah.
In the long term, and I'm concerned about adherence for those people. So my Guide to Flexible Dieting says, look, if you're expecting perfection, you've already failed. If you're expecting 100% or you're a failure, it's the I ate a cookie, I'm going to eat the bag syndrome. And they fall into that trap. So I go, look, just control it. Twice a week, you get to go out and have whatever the hell you want. Because if the other 90% of the week you're good, your diet's fine. And as soon as you put them in control of the food instead of the food in control of them, the psychology changes. And suddenly they're like, okay, I can diet for 4 days, but Friday I have to go with my family, take my kids out, go to Applebee's, get something gross, get some sweet, and I can go back on my diet. That's a, something that's very big that I promote, again, kind of within limits. You know,
although,
it has to be controlled to some degree.
I noticed, though, with my metabolic syndrome, I think is what's doing this, is I start to, if I were to have that Applebee's meal, I would start to slide into trouble.
Well, and this is something important to bring up because, Dr. Drew, you are not the average person in that you're so conscious of your eating typically. Yeah. And Lyle brought it up. It's the I had one cookie. I might as well have the bag.
Yeah.
That's something I fall into. And circles of people that I run with, it's that, you know, 90% of the time we are counting calories. We are weighing our chicken breasts to make sure. So when it's like we've fallen off that proverbial wagon.
Screw it.
You just go crazy because you get that taste. Yeah. You get that insulin surge. And it's like you.
See, I don't do that. I slide. Well, I chip.
What,
I start
what
chipping,
I watched
chipping,
with,
chipping.
What I've watched with you, Dr. Yeah. Drew, personally, just, yeah. you know, anecdotally from seeing it, yeah. is that you go overboard on things that are nutritious,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
they can destroy a diet. Things like almond butters or
oh,
peanut
yeah.
butters
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, or handfuls of nuts.
Yeah.
Even though it's handfuls of nuts and it seems healthy from, you know, an outsider's point of view,
yeah.
it's still 2,000 calories in 20 minutes
yes.
I've watched you put
yes.
away, you know?
Yes, yes
right.
you have.
And that is, and that's very much a trap people fall into. They go, oh, this is healthy. I can eat as much, and they don't realize that the calories always count.
Yes.
Yeah.
The low carbohydrates, those ketogenic diets, that became a real problem because it's one thing to eat low carb foods that are naturally occurring because those foods don't have a lot of calories. But at one point, they had low carb jelly beans that had
right.
and low carb Oreos that had just as many calories as the real thing. People were like, oh, as long as I don't eat carbs, I can eat as much as I want, and they end up eating too much.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And even with quote unquote healthy foods, people start shoveling the nuts in because these are healthy. Dude, the calories add up like you wouldn't believe, and calories do always account.
So let's talk about the different types of protein. Is there better beef, chicken, or salmon? Because Mike beats
again,
me about
honestly,
that.
Honestly, that's one of those details that people get, you know, a lot of it depends on the overall structure of the diet. Actually, let me get back to your initial question before people lose focus, and I'll come back to the sub-question. So you asked, you know, what should people eat? All right, dietary protein. For most people, I mean, it depends on activity, body fat, whatever. You know, bodybuilders always use that 1 gram per pound of lean body mass. And that's not a bad starting point. You know, that's 120, 130 grams of protein. For someone inactive, it's a little too much. For someone really active, it's maybe a little bit too little. But, you know, so like a 150-pound person with average body fat needs maybe 130 grams of protein a day at the high end. Okay, can of tuna, 30 grams of protein. Typical 4-ounce chicken breast, which is about the size of a deck of cards, about 30 grams of protein. Like 130 grams of protein sounds like a ton, but if you look at what restaurants serve you, a restaurant chicken breast is easily 8 or 10 ounces. It's easily 70 grams of protein. Mm. That's half of what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty easy to get in our modern meat-based society. You know, carbs, you know, somewhere 30, that same gram per pound works out about right. And that was kind of that zone diet approach. So again, you know, slice of bread, 12 grams, a cup of rice is maybe 30 grams of carbs. Same thing for a cup of pasta, a piece of fruit is 25. So if you're looking at 140 grams of carbs a day, that's, you know, it could be five.
That adds up fast, though. That adds up fast.
The carbs add up quickly, right? Yeah. And that's where people don't like, I always recommend tell people, look, if you're eating rice or pasta, like actually measure it out. Measure out what a serving of rice is because you're typically, the average person is eating three servings at once and has no clue because we don't. We've forgotten what a serving is.
Right.
Restaurants have served us such big meals for so long. Nobody knows what a serving size is. And I always tell people, look, eyeballing it is great. If you're like Mike and has 10 years of experience, if you're like me and have 20 years of experience, I can eyeball a meal and know how much most people, they need to break out the food measuring spoons, the food scale, and spend a week correlating what they see with what the measurement is. And once they've done that for a week, and it's a huge pain in the ass, then they will know what 4 ounces of chicken is, what a serving of pasta is, you know. And again, that's where those diets that just kind of eliminate those foods, like, vegetables, hard to go crazy with. Fruit, it can be done, but you have to really work to overeat fruit. French fries, pasta, rice, you can overeat that crap in a heartbeat. Bagels, bread, really easy to overeat. Because a typical bagel is 40 to 50 grams of carbs. That's one-third of this hypothetical person's
allotment. And I think people don't realize, like, a bran muffin is, like, 60 grams.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. Exactly, and 800. They think it's healthy. No, look at the – I mean, you want to be terrified. Look at the calorie count on Starbucks sugar coffees. typical Starbucks coffee is 1,000 calories.
Ugh.
That's over half of what a woman needs in a day.
So is there any type of beef, chicken, or salmon that we should be looking for? Because Mike's always saying, oh, this kind of salmon and this kind of chicken. I'm just happy when I'm eating those foods.
That's a bodybuilder neurosis thing.
Yeah.
For the average person, I'm less concerned where it comes from than that they get it down their gullet.
What is the neurosis? What is the neurosis about? I'm confused.
Bodybuilders, they're just neurotic by and large. There's an obsessive-compulsive personality type that goes with it. There's a new syndrome called orthorexia, where people associate moral good and bad with their eating choices. And we used to see this in the 20s and the 30s with like Kellogg and those food purists and food ecology. And for people, vegetarianism and bodybuilding diets become a moral choice.
This becomes
eat organic chicken breast, I'm superior to you morally. And it's like, dude, really?
This seems like the gluten thing is going there too in some weird way.
Sure. And what happens there is some people are allergic to stuff. And as soon as something becomes a hot topic food, you know, the way America does it is we decide something's healthy, then we overeat it, and then we rebel against it. We did it with wheat bran in the 80s. We did it with soy in the 90s. Right now, gluten intolerance, like 2 or 3% of people are truly gluten intolerant. But there's a lot of people that want to have something, kind of like, you know, when fibromyalgia was a fad?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like that, but with diet.
It was Epstein-Barr before that.
Everybody wants to have a thyroid problem. Everybody wants to be gluten intolerant. Everybody wants to be special and unique and a delicate flower like their mom told them. And so whenever something becomes, because food allergies are the same way.
It also gives us something to focus on as opposed to whatever the emotional landscape is that we're really troubled
very
by.
Very much so. And it gives us something to focus on that's not calories and that doesn't matter. Mm. So are some people gluten intolerant?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do some people feel better taking gluten out of their diet? Absolutely. Are the 75% of people that claim they are? Absolutely not.
Right.
You know, and for people, if they're getting the symptoms and they drop the food and they feel better, fantastic. So we went protein, carbs, dietary fats. You know, we found out from the 80s, very low fat diets people won't stick to. They taste like cardboard. They taste like shit. Nobody likes them. Very high fat diets contribute a lot of calories. So I like to see on average like that moderate dietary fat. Now, moderate means 10 to 15 grams of fat per meal, which isn't very much. That's 8 tablespoons of oil. That's 8 tablespoons of peanut butter. That's not a lot of fat. And that's something I really do recommend people to measure. So, like, if I was going to make a generic diet for somebody, they come to me, I'm working out 3 times a week, want to lose body fat, get healthier, blah, blah, blah. I would say maybe 1 gram per pound of protein, a little bit less, about 1 gram per pound of carbohydrates, and, you know, the rest of it's dietary fat, which will be like 10 grams per meal. And that would be a good generic diet.
As you age,
if they're super active, we add more carbs. They're super inactive. We may go ketogenic, low carbohydrate, but that would be a decent starting point.
As people age, do they need more protein?
That's an interesting question. Not only is it looking that older people do better with more protein, but are you guys familiar with the fast versus slow protein concept?
Yes.
Mike is. Go ahead and explain it.
Go ahead, Mike.
Some proteins, you know, release amino acids into your system at a slow rate, and some get into your system very quickly. Things like whey protein are going to get into your system rather quickly. Things like casein protein from the other part
like
of milk,
yogurt,
certain fatty fish, you know, that's going to take a long time to get into your system.
Correct. And what they're now finding is that older people, so not only do we typically become insulin resistant as we age, not only do we become, you know, resistant to testosterone and those hormones, there's actually an amino acid resistance. And in older people, they're showing that they do benefit from that fast spike of amino acids. For some reason, that helps overcome this age-related decline in skeletal muscle amino acid sensitivity. So, like, that's a place where it actually is starting to matter. Not only do they need probably more protein than is currently being recommended, but the type of protein really, really, really matters.
So what protein would that be?
Whey protein is kind of the classical fast protein. It digests very quickly. You get a big spike of amino acids. You know, there were studies way back in the day where they compared casein, which is one fraction of milk protein, and whey, which is another fraction of milk protein. And whey is fast and casein is slow. And for older people, using like a whey protein drink after their heavy resistance training will go a really long way towards offsetting that age-related muscle loss.
Are there any other sort of natural sources of whey protein?
I mean, like, all dairy products have a combination. All dairy is about 80% casein and 20% whey. And studies have actually shown that, like, chocolate milk is, like, the best thing you can have after post-workout because it's got some carbs, it's got calcium, it's got casein, it's got whey. Like, it's if people don't want to do the pill, powder, supplement route, chocolate milk post-workout is probably about the best thing they can pick, and tasty, too, so.
Fat-free, preferably? No?
What's that?
Fat-free?
Fat-free or low-fat, actually. Doesn't really matter. It all kind of ends up about the same place. So, yeah, so dairy would be a good choice if they don't want to do, you know, the whey protein powder, and not everyone's on the powder bandwagon.
How about managing appetite? That's something that very few people talk about, really.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the biggest problem is people are hungry, and a lot of people don't know how to be hungry.
Correct. And it's funny. I've got some friends that have some younger kids, and, you know, kids, and my friend who's got a five-year-old, she's like, I don't know what to do. She won't be hungry at mealtime, and then an hour later, she's hungry. I'm like, little kids' bodies regulate hunger the way it's supposed to. You eat when you're hungry and not when you're not. We get trained as we get older to eat at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whether we're hungry or not. There's also a lot of hunger is not real hunger. It's psychological hunger. There's been numerous studies. If you show someone a pizza commercial, they'll want pizza. Not because they're hungry. I mean, advertisers know this. This is how advertisers make their money. So there's kind of a big push on kind of mindfulness approaches to appetite and hunger. And again, it's kind of this weird dichotomy. When you deal with bodybuilders and athletes, you don't have to worry about the hunger. You don't have to worry about the adherence. You don't have to worry about the behavioral stuff. They've got all that dialed down or they wouldn't be where they're at. You got to worry with them about the details. But for everybody else, which is the majority, you got to worry about adherence. It's not about the diet. It's what they can stick to. And hunger management is a really big part of that. So one of the things that a lot of books have dealt with, and you even addressed it with some of the emotional stuff, and which is often part of this whole picture, is learning to recognize true hunger versus boredom, depression, because you're out with some friends,
yeah.
You know, that there's reasons that we think we're hungry or that we think we want to eat that have nothing to do with actual physiological hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And learning that takes sort of practice of, you know, we get hungry and you just sort of, the simplest rule is wait 10 minutes. And if the hunger goes away, you weren't really hungry. You might have been thirsty, you might have been bored, you might have seen a TV commercial. Because real hunger doesn't go away like that.
I've noticed, though, that if I need to be on a weight loss diet, I do not lose weight. Unless I'm hungry, that's something about my body. I know for sure I'm not losing if I'm not hungry.
No, I've known a lot of people that what they find is that if they're just like chronically a little bit hungry, that's the sweet spot for them.
Right.
This is something that people don't want to hear or believe.
It's hard to deal
with,
though.
Everybody wants weight loss to be super easy, and you're always going to be full all the time. And I got news for you. It's not. If it were easy, everybody would do it. But they are of this mindset that they're never, ever going to be hungry, so they don't know how to deal with it.
I actually had an email exchange with a young lady who was a listener of the Kevin and Bean Show when I was talking about weight loss and nutrition, things like that. She emails me. She says, what do I do? I'm trying this diet, that diet. I've been working for 3 months. What do I do about cravings and hunger? I go, don't give into it.
And she responded
back to me, fuck you. As if I was she really did. That was her exact – she's like, you're such a – you know, you don't have to be so condescending. I was like, no, you don't – I don't think you understand what I'm saying. That's part of the deal.
I've had patients, you know, I got to tell you, Lyle, that are actually frightened by hunger. They cannot deal with it.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, like there's been a lot of research recently that, you know, that there may be a food addiction, that it's neurochemically similar to drug addiction. And like in animals, like they get them addicted to, you know, sugar. And when they take that away, they actually show withdrawal symptoms.
Oh, I have full-blown.
I'm
going to tell you something. If you have metabolic syndrome, you get carb withdrawal. I notice
every
time I cut carbs out, I get irritable, depressed, desperate, all the things my heroin addicts get. For sure, about four days.
And it's because serotonin levels drop, and you know that eating carbs will make you feel better. And it becomes so, like, hunger is negative reinforcement. Like, it's a negative reward. And then if you eat, hunger goes away. So what are you – you're training yourself to reward hunger by eating. And the reality is I wrote this article a few years ago. It was called 10 Ways to Deal with Hunger on a Diet. And it was stuff like eat more protein, eat more vegetables, moderate dietary fat, drink more water – exercise for a lot of people tends to blunt hunger. And you know what number 10 was?
What?
Suck it up or stay fat.
Yeah.
Because once you've exhausted all the dietary, nutritional, like, I mean, fine, look at it, you know, look at appetite suppressing drugs if it's really bad. But once you've exhausted all that, you got two options. You can suck it up or you can stay fat. And nobody wants to hear that, but that's the truth.
Well, you mentioned appetite suppressing things. Chewing gum, drinking coffee. Are there little other cues? Give us some tricks.
You kind of hit on it. You know, for a lot of people, again, it's not even that they're hungry. It's just they're finding, just like with drugs, just like with alcoholism, there are cues in the environment. Being in the kitchen, for some people, if you always eat in the kitchen, you associate being in the kitchen with eating. It becomes a subconscious trigger for this emotional memory that makes you want to send you to see a TV commercial that shows food. So, like, sometimes it's a matter of management. Sometimes you can avoid the situation. If you can't avoid the situation, you need to redirect it. So you see that, you're like, man, I really want a cookie. Like, fine, go chew some gum, go for a walk, go read an article, go do something to distract yourself for the 10 minutes it's going to take for that craving to go away. Now, if it truly doesn't abate, like truly 10 minutes later you are still hungry, well, guess what? Have something small to eat. Because if people skip that, not only are they not kind of learning to respect your list, but then they end up binging worse later on.
Right.
Like, they're just like, I'm going to skip this meal and I'm going to be, and then at dinner they end up eating four times as much as they otherwise would because they're starving to death. So it's a happy balance to find sometimes. But first you have to really get in touch with, okay, is this real hunger or am I just being triggered because I watched something? Here's an interesting data point for you. They've shown that at, like, social events, the more people that are present, the more food people eat. And it's a linear relationship. So if you're out with one person, if you're on a date, you're pretty attentive to it. You don't want to look like a pig in front of your date. You go to a party with 12 people, and you will eat literally 50% more. Because what do social events revolve around? Food. I think there's also some weird evolutionarily conserved mentality of, you know, when we were pack hunter-gatherers, when did you get together? When you had something big to eat.
Right.
So our brains go, 12 people, pack, fire, eat, food, and it's a very strong relationship that for most people it's not even biological.
It's a feast at that hunger. It's a feast at that point.
Yes, and your brain goes, feast.
Yeah.
And what do? Also, we play this little game of, oh, it's Thanksgiving. I'm supposed to eat till I get sick.
Right.
That's cultural. That's traditional. Calories at Christmas don't count. We all know that Christmas cookies don't count.
Right.
And that's typically when people gain weight is at the holidays.
So Mike,
they then don't take off later in the year.
Mike, geek out for a little bit. What stuff do you want him to
do? Well, I wanted to cover for a lot of people who are listening who maybe aren't the general public, who are younger guys or people or women who are, you know, really looking to take their body to the next level. I wanted to, Lyle, as a guy who has kind of pulled back the curtain on the fitness industry, I've noticed since I've married my wife, who is an actress, and she is – I don't want to out anybody, but she has friends that are A-list actresses.
Sure.
I've watched from behind this, you know, my new peek behind this curtain, that a lot of people don't understand that the guy or gal you see on camera has used drugs to get the physique he or she is got.
And that's actually true, not even of, you know, acting and that, but even the bodybuilding and fitness industry has been based around smoke and mirrors since day one. Anabolic steroids were invented in the 30s and 40s during World War II, and they've been part of that world since about the 50s. But the magazines don't like to talk about that because they don't want it. I mean, Arnold used drugs. He's been honest about it. All those guys, even John Grimmick, who was an early 1950s literate, thought that in all the people now, even the fitness competitors, typically are using a low-dose anabolic steroid, Winstrol, something really light. They're using clenbuterol. They're using thyroid medication. They're using appetite suppressants. And what people see is they see them on that one day of their sterling, perfect physique. They don't see them the rest of the year when they look like shit.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pro bodybuilders that bulk up to, you know, 30% body fat because with enough drugs, they can get in contest shape. But they're the one, just like the actors and actresses, they hold themselves up, and they have to lie about it because in this puritanical society, they can never say, yeah, I did drugs. You know, not only are they using steroids or weight loss drugs, they've got a personal chef, they've got a personal trainer, a personal trainer, and it's real easy to get into shape when it's get into shape or lose an $8 million movie deal.
Yeah.
That's really good motivation. The average person doesn't have that.
And also, that's a very good point. And a lot of these, especially with the women's match, because I almost feel bad for women.
Carolla
told a very similar story. I actually heard back on a podcast. He was talking about Julianne Hough, his dancing partner on Dancing with the Stars, about how she would come into to rehearsal and eat like a ferret let loose at 7-Eleven, nothing but you know red vines and jelly beans, and then you go go to the supermarket the next day and see you're on Self magazine, the Julianne Hough get ripped for summer diet, and I saw it to a T with every female dancer on Dancing. They all eat pizza. And Carmen Electra came in to Kevin and Bean back when she was doing Starsky and Hutch, and in the time that she was doing her interview, ate two regular bagels and two normal sodas, not diet sodas. And she goes, "This is how I eat. This is really life. You know, I was born by Carmen Electra's parents, and this is how I look. You know, and women shouldn't get confused as to like there's some kind of weird trick that I use to get the look the way I do."
But the thing is that that's not what sells magazines, and that's not what sells supplements, and that's not what sells products.
Yeah.
Another one that was kind of this is big in like the late 80s, early 90s, I'm sure y'all remember this, was like this before and after transformation.
Yeah.
Yes.
That sold a lot of product. Okay, that became a growth industry. What people would do is they would get these really fit people would get out of shape. And once you've been in shape, it's really easy to get back in shape.
Yeah.
They would get out of shape, take the before picture, get back in shape quickly, take the after picture. They would get paid $10,000. Like, it became a business for them to just cycle in and out of shape and claim that it was the magic product or the magic pill or the Metarex or whatever the hell it was. But, like, that was their job, was to just get – they went from being fit to being sloppy, and then it's really easy to get fit again. So, like, the whole industry – It's mostly lies and bullshit, and it unfortunately misleads a lot of people. Because again, the magazines make money off of supplements. Back in the day, Joe Weider used to invent studies that had never been done. And I know this because my exercise physiology professor was a legal expert in the court case, because they claimed a study was done at UCLA that was never done. So UCLA took him to court.
Wow.
And Joe Weider, they pay the FTC, and they still make 10 times the money that they
paid out.
They locked in legal fees, but the whole industry is kind of beset by that.
More geeky questions.
Which is a big part of why I'm sort of like the most hated man in the industry. You know, Mike sort of mentioned that. I'm one of the few that won't toe the bottom line. I won't sell the bullshit. I won't. When people say crap, I call them out on it. And then they get all aggro with me and they dismiss me and whatever. But people that have read my stuff know that, okay, when I'm tired of the crap and I want the truth, I'm the go-to guy. Alan Aragon is another really good guy in the industry. Tom Venuto is another really good guy in the industry. But for most people, the money is in selling lies, and that's what they do.
What's your training again, Lau?
What's that?
Your training?
My background is – it's funny, very similar background. I got involved in weight training in high school, joined one of the old 80s clubs. That actually led me to UCLA, where I got a bachelor's degree in exercise physiology. And kind of went through some different stuff of wanting to be a physical therapist and a coach, and then sort of got into this training thing. You know, I always lifted weights. I was never very good at it. I'm an endurance athlete. Like, I was a good cyclist. I was a fantastic inline skater. I actually went to Salt Lake City for 5.5 years and tried to be an ice speed skater and make Olympic trial. Like, I'm a slow twitch, but I always loved the iron. I was never very good at it, but I loved it. So I went to UCLA, graduated.
I think Mike and I are sort of I'm particularly the opposite.
Yeah.
I'm completely opposite.
Yeah.
Right,
I gasped pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those things that because I wasn't really naturally gifted at it, that was a big part of what drove my obsession. In hindsight, the reason I was so obsessive about diet, you know, I was a former fat kid because I was chubby when I was little. I always wanted to be a better athlete than I was. So, you know, I wanted to fix myself. I kind of turned it into a career. But anyway, so bachelor's degree in exercise physiology, you know, I had trainer certifications. I've worked with the general public, powerlifters, bodybuilders. I got involved in early low-carbohydrate dieting in the 90s, which led me to write my first book called The Ketogenic Diet, which is this 325-page monstrosity. It's sort of a reference manual for low-carb diets. It's great if you can't sleep, and I wouldn't recommend it beyond that.
But it's an excellent source. It's been practically a Bible for me as far as understanding metabolism and stuff
just,
like that.
It's just boring as shit. It's just very much written like a textbook. And then, you know, I wrote many of, you know, and I kind of jump around. I write some stuff for the general public. Then I like to write stuff for hardcore bodybuilders, like Ultimate Diet 2.0. It's a very meticulous cyclical diet for people that want to get to 5% body fat and keep the muscle. Then there was the Stubborn Fat Solution, which dealt with like men's abdominal and women's lower body fat issues. That was a project that actually I worked on for a decade and then finally wrote it when it was time to write it. I've written this book called The Protein Book, which is just all about dietary protein for athletes. Then I've got Guide to Flexible Dieting, which is really sort of a behavioral, how to avoid that trap of, you know, I ate a cookie, eat the bag thing. I've got the Rapid Fat Loss Handbook, which is, it's a scientifically based crash diet. And I wrote that because the fact is people are going to crash diet, period. You can't stop them.
Yeah.
Kind of like teenagers are going to screw, people are going to drink. You can't stop it, so let's at least make them do it safely.
Or do it, yeah.
So I wrote this book that was like, if you're going to do this, and I even addressed, here's where this is appropriate and here's where this is not appropriate. I was very, very direct about that. Like this, there are risks. Don't do this just because you want to do it. Do it because you need to. You've got a wedding, a high school reunion, you're an athlete that needs to make weight. Like, here are the specific situations. But I'm like, if you're going to do this, at least do it right. At least
safely.
Do it in the safest way possible so that you don't get broken off. So that's kind of why, and of course, not unsurprisingly, that's a perennial bestseller just because of the title, because everybody wants to lose, you know, 7 pounds
of
fat
loss. Yeah,
20 pounds in 2 weeks. And
nice. Let's talk about working out.
We got to transition
to working out now. So what?
Yeah.
So that's a dicier topic to put into a few minutes, I suppose.
Sure.
Let me ask Mike. Ask the geek questions first.
Well, I was going to would you recommend overall? I mean, with the advent of CrossFit and things like that, you're starting to see more people accept the idea of a woman getting into a squat rack, and you know, just that obsession with cardio that you mostly see from females.
Correct.
Has kind of died down a little bit, but there's still tremendous metabolic and health advantages for people to lift weights, including, you know, petite females. Am I correct?
No, absolutely. There's, you know, and again, this is one of those places that the bodybuilders for 4 decades said, lift weights. And the researchers said, no. And then they actually studied it and they were like, yeah, I guess you guys were right.
By the way, Lyle, those are the same researchers that were saying anabolic steroids really don't do anything.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Remember that research?
Yeah.
They don't increase strength. I don't understand why anybody would want to do those. The bodybuilders are like, no. We'll do them, thank you.
Yes. And so, you know, honestly, like if you had to pick, and like I don't like to turn it into an either or sort of thing. For most people, a balance is going to be ideal. But genuinely from the standpoint of bone density, skeletal muscle loss, insulin sensitivity, like you name it, weight training is about the closest thing you're ever going to get to like a quick fix, but that's going to address all. Like cardio aerobic activities certainly address some aspects of it, but cardio just cannot do what weight training does. We know that for women, building peak bone density at a young age keeps them from having osteoporosis later. Weight training does that in a way that cardio doesn't. Cardio taken to an extreme can actually make it worse. I've met some female runners that gave themselves, you know, had hip replacements at age 22 by overdoing it. From the standpoint of that age-related muscle loss, from having enough strength to just simply do functional activities, like we've all got that mother that they can't pick up the garbage anymore because it's too heavy, because an 8-pound bag of garbage, cardio won't fix that. They did studies years ago that 90-year-old people can gain strength still. Not tons. They're not going to be huge, but they can get enough strength to where they can get out of a chair, to where they can be functional, to where they don't have to be carried to the toilet.
Dr. Drew's going to be huge at 90.
I plan to be huge.
Dr. Drew's going to be massive.
What about all these anti-aging interventions that bring the growth hormone, all this business being...
I can't honestly, drugs are not my area of interest or expertise. So anything I'm going to say needs to be couched within I know a little bit. You know, there certainly is, like we've known, menopause. Women's estrogen or progesterone.
Testosterone. That's the part they missed.
In men, yeah. But in men, it's not quite as direct. Like, it's not that it stops being produced, but it certainly goes down.
Yeah.
And there's certainly some rationale to at least hormone replacement therapy with testosterone, with, you know, growth hormone tends to go down. Like, a lot of shit goes wrong as we get older. I mean, it's usually about, you know, late 50s, early, and most of the anti-aging groups that I know, what little I've looked at, you know, they're not trying to turn you into a monster.
Right.
But if they want to keep your hormones at kind of that peak health, which is, you know, mid to late 20s, kind of in that range, it's turning out to be having, you know, a lot of health benefits, keeps your muscles good, keeps the body fat from accumulating, it probably keeps your brain healthier. You know, andropause is sort of the new term. It's not really analogous, because in men it's more of a gradual decline, whereas women it's a switch. But the effect is still there. Certainly testosterone levels start to drop, and by the time you're in your 60s, you're effectively castrate, and the muscle falls off, your bones fall off, you get heart disease, like everything goes bad. I think the biggest drawback with it is it's expensive, but certainly there's some guys, you know, there's guys out there that know a million times more about that topic than I do, but yeah. Certainly as I've gotten older, and I mean, I'm in my early 40s, stuff doesn't fix itself as quickly. My knees hurt a little bit more. I don't recover quite as quickly from workouts. You know, I've considered getting on some even basic, and I had low testosterone to begin with, or low normal. For me, I've really considered hormone replacement therapy, or there's a lot of doctors here in Austin that would do that. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some benefits to it for sure.
And you have to be careful. We don't know the effects on prostate cancer and vascular pathology
correct.
Yet. So.
And it's there, you know, there's pros and cons. Even with women, we found out the hard way.
Yeah.
You replace hormones and they are healthier, but they're at high risk for breast cancer.
Right.
So there's always pros and cons to all of this. And lately, you know, that's something that does have to be considered for sure.
So Mike, the geek workout question.
Yeah, workout stuff again.
Every meathead is going to say that, and I've been one of those guys at times. In order to get the results you want, you absolutely have to deadlift, squat, and bench press, or power clean,
whatever.
There are those key exercises that anybody who spends any time in a gym says you have to do. Is that in fact true, or can you see the same benefits from leg press and lunges?
Isolated, actually, like a dumbbell.
Yeah, and the answer is within a certain range, yes. Like one thing we know is that bones have to be loaded directly. Like you need spinal loading, you need femoral loading. You know, realize that the reason squats and deadlifts became popular is because in the 1930s, that's all you could do.
Yeah.
There weren't, and actually some of the early leg presses were hilarious. The guys used to actually put a barbell in their boot. There's a picture of this on my website where they'd put it in the heel of their boot and they would leg press laying on their back with the barbell. Machines didn't exist.
Wow.
And that's what explains that really, that machine bias or that barbell bias. And certainly those are great exercises. But here's the thing. What meatheads forget is when they started training, they were in their 20s, they were coached properly. If I have a 50-year-old man or 50-year-old woman who's starting weight training, do you think they have the coordination, the ability, or the desire to deadlift?
No way.
And that becomes an adherence issue. The best advice, you know, good advice not followed is bad advice. And the best exercises in the world are no good if the person won't do them. So sometimes, you know, a leg press that loads the shoulders, that loads the spine, will still have a benefit on spinal health. A bench press machine is functionally, it'll still load the upper arm and the forearm, just like a barbell bench press, but without. And what happens, you know, the meatheads, until you've trained a ranked beginner, I'm sorry, but you don't get to have an opinion about training a ranked beginner.
Right.
Because until you've seen someone that doesn't even have the basic coordination to do a bodyweight squat, you have no business putting them under a bar. But that's what happens. They get so myopic about, well, this is what I do. I've been doing this 20 years. This is my workout. Why can't you do it? Like, go be a beginner. Go be a beginner without a movement background. Go be the typical 35-year-old woman who is petrified of being in the weight room because all she sees are buff jackasses and hot chicks, and she wants to go to curbs.
Yeah.
Like, they don't realize that sometimes you have to accommodate to people. What I find is that if you start them on something they can do, frequently 6 months down the road, they're like, I want the next level. But let them make that choice. Like, I'm kind of the opinion that, you know, I know a lot of people are down on Planet Fitness and Lunk Alarm and this and that and the other. But you know what? We have a society that is 80% inactive. Anything that gets them in the gym is good. Anything. Anything that's not hurting them, and that brings us back to CrossFit.
Right.
But anything that gets them active, don't be such a myopic, perfectionist pinhead that just because it's not what you like, they shouldn't do it. If Planet Fitness gets people's butts in the gym, I'm all for it.
I'm with you on that.
Which brings us to CrossFit.
Well, let me ask a geek
problem,
question before I ask the CrossFit.
Go ahead.
I've noticed I have extremely long limbs, and I get a
and cock
that too.
Just thought
I get a ton out of concentrated exercise that other people don't
seem
to get. I seem
that,
to I really get a lot out, and I can go pretty heavy too, which is sort of counterintuitive.
Which is another biomechanic, it's an issue that, here's what happens. People that say the squat is the best exercise, without fail, are built to squat.
Yeah.
I'm built to squat, I'm like Mike, I've got short femurs, my torso is pretty compact, like I'm a short guy. Like, squats and deadlifts work for me. Now, one of my trainees, she was 5'11", she wasn't super strong in her core, and squats were a terrible exercise for her.
Mm-hmm.
She had these incredibly long legs. She had this incredibly long torso, and invariably her low back or her, you know, something would give out that wasn't her legs.
Yeah.
I put her on leg press or a leg extension, and suddenly she can work her muscles in a way that a squat or a deadlift will never do for her.
That's me.
So there is a biomechanical aspect, and generally people with longer limbs, longer upper arms, longer legs do tend to get a better, you know, and here's the thing, your muscles don't know from exercises. They
right.
know tension,
yeah.
and they know fatigue.
Yeah.
All they know is that they've had to work. They don't know what exercises can be better or worse for safety and tension and fatigue or whatever, but fundamentally, a heavy set of leg extensions, if it targets your quads better than a squat, that's a better exercise for you. Might not be a better exercise for someone else, but for your mechanics, that may be the better movement, or a leg press. You know, people that have a weak low back, if they're squatting, what gives out first? Their low back.
Yeah.
It's not a leg exercise for them.
Yep.
Or they have to lean over so far, whatever it is. For them, a leg press, oh no, it's a machine, it's isolated. Right. If it gives them a better training effect, who gives a shit?
CrossFit.
Whatever will train their muscles and hit their bones along the long axis is the best exercise that they can do safely and progressively is the best for them.
We are Lyle, running out of time, and Mike and I could
okay.
geek out with you all day, but tell us the CrossFit story before we go.
It's not even a story, all right? So CrossFit kind of came about, and it's this very random, put-together kind of program, and it's basically a cult. Like, they've gotten a lot of people that want that group dynamic, that group exercise, and certainly it's got a lot of people exercising. The problem is that CrossFit, they're very, like, they embrace injuries. Like, they've actually had people get rhabdomyolysis, where, you know, kidneys shut down.
Muscle breakdown.
Because they take beginners, and they throw them into the grinder. But rather than going, hey, our workout's fucked up, they have T-shirts that say "Yay Rhabdo."
Huh.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it is. It's like a badge of honor with it.
So it's to be injured, to have slap tears in the shoulder, to have be wearing that kinesio tape all the time. They've turned injuries, and I don't like to see that. I certainly it has its time and its place. It's got a lot of people exercising, but it's injuring so many people because they don't scale it. Everyone gets the same generic workout. And that's for beginners. Beginners need to start at the beginner level. And 6 weeks from now, they may be completely prepared for it. But in the beginning stages, CrossFit, to me, and it's funny, CrossFit's evolving now, and they're like, well, now we do pure strength training, and then we don't do power cleans for metabolic work anymore, and we just do the rope shit. So, like, they're sort of adapting, but there's a lot of mentality in that culture of, if you got injured, you just weren't tough enough. Like, this isn't the military, you moron.
Right.
Like, this is about getting in shape and being fit, not hurting people, so...
Well, Lyle, we got to go. Mike and I could talk to you all day and get into get into the weeds and all this for sure.
We love
this guy. And I think we have to do this again. I'm sorry to say.
No, absolutely. I'd love to.
Because I'd like to get into some
of that. You can ask me about my super secret project, and I can tease you about it. So.
All right. Super secret project. I want to hear about it. And a little more. People love to talk about the specifics of dietary physiology.
And they don't
know what the F they're talking about. So
exactly.
we did a little nuance of it with proteins and carbs today, but we can get into the weeds a little bit more on that.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it very much. That's Lyle, bodyrecomposition.com. Lyle McDonald is the expert. We will have all the books up at doctor.com. Mike Catherwood from Loveline is at Mike Catherwood, with a C, Catherwood.
A lot of good tweets from me.
A lot
of dog pics.
And a lot of pictures of chihuahvas.
Awesome.
And,
hey, dog dicks. I got two dogs. I see dog dicks all the time.
Yeah. A lot of dog penis.
All right, Lyle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Drew.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
And we will talk to you again soon. And that about does the Dr. Drew podcast. See you next time.